Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
So how did you first come across this mystery cassette tape story?
So I was tagged in a Facebook post online, and this happens to me all the time, because whenever there's something to do with the cassette, my friends seem to know that I need to be alerted.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect. And that other voice in the studio is Sound Effect contributor Warren Langford.
Hello.
And the very first story that Warren did for Sound Effect was a cassette mystery, trying to find the identity of some sounds on a tape. And then, lo and behold, years after that story, you sent us an email about this other thing. So what was it that caught your eye about this story, and what was it exactly?
There's so many things about this story that resonate with me. First of all, cassette, ding. Second of all, weird synthy disco music, ding. And third of all, it's a mystery. I love a freaking mystery.
Well, so normally we have a theme here on Sound Effect every week, and we gather a bunch of stories from the Northwest that fit into the theme. But this week we're doing something pretty different. That email that you sent us about the mystery disco cassette sent us down this whole rabbit hole, and it led to one unusual story after another. And so what we're going to do now, this hour, is take you with us down the rabbit hole and hear all the stories that we wound up getting hip to because of that original email. And then Warren's going to sit in with us. And this is the first time you've heard all these, right? You haven't heard these before?
No. This is all new to me.
All right. So we're going to kind of drop the pretense and just explain how we and our producers get from one story to the next, and Warren's going to find out where this whole rabbit hole leads. Are you ready?
I'm vibrating with anticipation.
Okay. We're going to start in the obvious place. We wanted to talk to the guy who found the John Doe disco cassette. It's a guy named Tom Deslongchamp. He's an artist and a designer and does a little bit of everything, but he is a kindred spirit to you, Warren. I think he got obsessed with this tape, and it sent him down a rabbit hole of its own. So we're going to hear his story now.
So last June, my friend Tim Manthe, we've been friends for a while, he invited me. He loves the Goodwill outlet in SoDo. I saw this media bin that was full of books and VHS tapes and cassette tapes. And this digital age we live in, I'm still very intrigued in analog formats. So I had recently bought a cassette tape player, like a little handheld one that looks like a Walkman, and needed some tapes to record on. And I get to the bottom and I see a white cassette tape with an orange label. So I picked it up, looked at it. And it's got this Cinema Sound Corporation, which sounded kind of intriguing. Like, wow, is this stuff made for a movie on it? Like music or score? So I brought it home and popped it into my tape player and started playing it to check for content. And I played it fast forward and played it fast forward through one side and didn't find anything. So I rewound it and decided to just start using it as a blank tape for my own recordings.
What kind of stuff did you record on it?
I like to be creative a lot. And I would start doing improvised little snippets of situations with characters, oftentimes sort of cowboy sounding, tough guy stuff, which is like the opposite of me.
Everybody stand up. There's a hold up. I mean, get down. I mean, Jerry, what do we do? What do we make them do?
And when I play it back, like, it's like a new version of my childhood where I got to just have all these tapes that were my favorite tapes. They're like your favorite movies or your favorite albums. I liked making my own stuff, which is fun.
You bring a piano into a helicopter, and you hit all the keys with the chopper blades, and it goes like this. And it turns into
so you tape some of that material on what you take to be a blank tape, and then what happens next?
I was on a bus ride downtown to go to the dentist, and I brought the tape with me, and I flipped it over, and then all of a sudden this like synthesizer and beat comes on. And then I hear lyrics. And I'm like immediately on my phone Googling the lyrics and trying to find a lyric match, because I thought, well, this is probably a mix. It's probably just someone's favorite songs that they recorded onto a tape. And I just wasn't finding anything. And it was really kind of, I was getting really excited, like adrenaline pumping in my head, because I'm like, is this someone's demo tape? There's 7 songs on it, and I listened to almost all of them on the way to the dentist and was just, oh man, how do I figure out who this is, you know?
Why?
That's a good question. Each song has its own emotional tone, and there is a common thread running through all of it of like loneliness and longing and desire, and that's what I think good art is about. It's like spilling your guts to the world, whether people care or not, you know? So that's why, I mean... Yeah.
So you have this unlabeled cassette tape from the bottom of a bin in Goodwill. It's obviously decades old, not very much at all to go on. How did you even approach trying to solve the mystery?
Digitizing the music and trying to share it with people was my first idea. Making a website that was very simple, that was just about, here's the lyrics, here's the music. Do you know who this is? You know, and I've been searching for people that were around during that time that are the same age that may have been interested in the same things that this John Doe was into. I mean, I've been looking, researching old clubs in Seattle and trying to talk to people who went to those clubs, like Shelley's Leg and Tugs.
What were the clues that you pulled out of the tape and that you were kind of operating under?
I shared the music on Reddit, and there was a fella on there, I can't remember his name, it might have been Josh or something, but he did some digging, and he uncovered a very important clue, which was that he found a record, a single called Fast Friends, that was pressed in the UK in 1979, and it's the same song as the first song. So,
but not the same recording, right?
It's not the same recording, it's the same song. It's a woman singing. And I think John Doe liked that single and was inspired to create a cover. That's a great clue because that helps date the music. That single came out in 1979, so that makes his cover of it after that. So that's 1979 1980.
So you mentioned Shelley's Leg. What was that place and what made you think of that?
One of the songs on the tape is, we call it Disco Palace, and it's, he's just raving about this disco palace, and I'm just like thinking, like, that's such fantastic language. It sounds like it's this crazy disco land, you know, where everyone dancing all night, you'll never be alone at the Disco Palace, dancing all night at the Disco Palace. So I thought, well, man, this Shelley's Leg sounds like a wild place. It sounds like people would dance all night. It's probably a lot of cocaine involved. But there are a lot of people just not around anymore. It's kind of hard to find people even from Shelley's Leg. Even Shelley's passed away a few years ago.
How long have you been at this now?
3 or 4 months.
Do you think you're going to find the answer?
I can't say yes or no, but I know that it's worth trying. You know, investigation like this brings people together and you meet people you never would have. And I appreciate Seattle's past and history more. But, you know, even if we don't find who John Doe Disco is, his music can be appreciated. He can become a legend, because if he's never uncovered, it's an endless legend that we can develop our own mythology about, which is kind of fun.
What do you think it is about you and your personality that makes this a bit of an obsession for you?
I think I've always had this in me. I remember in college, I found a bundle of thrown away photos in the garbage, and I pulled them out and kept them. And I think I still have some of them today, which is slightly hoardy, but obviously someone threw those things away and they didn't want them anymore. And there was probably some sort of heartbreak involved, honestly, because photos, to throw away photos, it's a pretty like dramatic act. And, my theory is that I'm sensitive to artifacts of human clue. So when I find evidence of someone's life that feels like I can feel it, I can feel their life in a very small way. It's like kind of the tip of an iceberg where you're like, wow, I just have this piece. What's the life like? You know, John Doe Disco is like my mystery that I can keep trying to learn about.
Well, Tom DeLongchamp is a freelance animator, artist, illustrator, and we'll post a link to his website for John Doe Disco at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Tom, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for caring. Thanks for being interested.
Good luck on the search. I hope that if you do figure out who John Doe is, you'll come back and tell us.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell the world.
Well, it's Gabriel Spitzer here. I'm here with sound effect contributor Warren Langford.
Hello.
I wanted to know what you thought about that story, Warren.
I really, really connect with it because, yeah, you're right. He's kind of a kindred spirit to me. But, you know, you find something like this and, yeah, it's discarded and it is a part of someone's life. Having had worked at I worked in a video store for like 9 years, that there's something about, you know, being able to pick up something and look at it and feel it and connect with it. And, you know, there's like attaching this personality to things, and we don't have those things anymore.
Yeah. Well, we're grateful that you alerted us to this thing's existence. And like I said before, it did send us down this whole rabbit hole. And after this, things took kind of a weird turn. Warren, do you remember when Tom DeLongchamp, the John Doe Disco guy, mentioned this particular odd thing?
I mean, I've been looking, researching old clubs in Seattle and trying to talk to people who went to those clubs, like Shelley's Leg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it came up a few times. He thought it might hold the key to this disco tape because it was one of the first above ground gay discos in the country, and certainly here in Seattle. Okay, well, sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad started snooping around a little bit, and he soon found out that this club, Shelley's Leg, was owned in the 70s by this very interesting woman named Shelley Bauman. And Kevin tracked down a guy who knew her. His name is Bruce Bowles. He was a radio DJ in the 70s and a good friend of Shelley's. And Bruce explained a little bit about the kind of person that Shelley Bauman was.
She could be a little bit mean. She could be a little edgy and opinionated, and she carried with that the force of her circumstances. Because she had been injured and was, you know, disabled, and because she had a bunch of money. That was a big thing about Shelley. She got a large settlement from, I guess, the city for this accident and was spending it. She had red hair. She smoked cigarettes. I think she may have even used a cigarette holder sometimes. She drank. She had a big black Lincoln Continental. She had a pet tarantula, which was sort of in keeping with her mystique. And she had a big black Doberman pincer named Lucifer. She usually had guns around. She'd have a pistol by her bed.
How did Shelley Bauman get injured?
There had been a Bastille Day celebration that included a cannon that had been had a wad of paper in there. As I understand it, the paper was meant to be dry, but somehow it had been wet. Somebody had poured water on it. So it made a much more dense projectile. And this cannon went off. I think it was deliberately, but I'm not sure exactly the circumstances. But the cannon went off, and it hit her.
And this wad, it's
this wad, this cannon wad of wet paper hit her, you know, at full force in the gut, and just pretty well destroyed her her lower abdomen, and she was in the hospital for a long time, and she listened to KOL FM, and she would call, and one of the fellow DJs at KOL was a guy named Marty Seaver. She struck up a conversation, or a friendship, I should say, with Marty. And they got to be friends, and he would go visit her, and then she got out of the hospital, and it turned into a romance, and they ended up living together. And Marty and I were friends. So through him, I got to know Shelley.
Can you describe what sort of injuries she suffered?
She was hit in the lower abdomen, and so she had a lot of reconstructive surgery. She had a leg amputated. I believe it was her left leg. So she had the mobility issue. She was in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. There was no walkers or anything of the kind. She was always in a wheelchair.
Shelley Bauman decided with her settlement that she was going to build a nightclub. Can you describe that nightclub?
Well, it was cleverly described as being at the foot of Maine, down at the corner there of Maine and Alaska Way. And it was almost always packed. It had a raised platform with for the DJ, so the DJ was fairly prominent.
And it was a gay bar.
Yeah. It was a gay bar, but it didn't, you know, as a straight guy, I didn't feel like I had was in a place where I shouldn't be. I think the what really characterized it, in addition to being a gay bar, that it was a disco. And that was approaching the height of the disco era. So if you were straight or gay and Disco Inferno comes on, you want to get up and shake your butt. And that's what people did. So it was about, a lot of it was about the music and the dancing. In fact, I'm pretty sure that one of the reasons she started Shelley's Leg was so that Marty could be a DJ. So I think she was aware that there were these clubs in New York or Chicago or LA where DJs were playing records live in front of people. And she said, I can do that for Marty and my gay friends and for me. And it all kind of came together. But I think that was one of her motivations.
Did she demand attention?
Yeah, that's. I think she did. I think that's an interesting way of putting it, that she wanted it. She definitely thrived on the attention. I think she was looking for love. She really was. From Marty, of course. I think she was looking for love from her friends, and she was certainly looking for love from my daughter. At the time, Phoebe was, I don't know, 3-4 years old when she started, when Shelley kind of laid eyes on her, and Shelley just loved her. And Phoebe loved her back, and Phoebe spent quite a bit of time with her. One of the images that I have very strongly is of Phoebe riding in Shelley's wheelchair and sitting right on the seat where her leg wasn't. So there was this perfect little nesting spot for Phoebe to sit there, and Shelley just loved having Phoebe around.
Was drinking a problem for her?
Yeah, it really became a problem. Yeah, she was an alcoholic. There was cocaine and marijuana around as well, and nicotine. She was a big smoker. Yeah.
Was she regularly in pain?
I think so, yeah. She was in and out of the hospital frequently. And infections were always a great threat to her because of her, the state of her overall health and her reconstructed abdomen. So I wouldn't be surprised if she was, but I don't know what kind of painkillers were around in those days.
Well, alcohol, cocaine, marijuana.
Well, yeah, those were around. We could see those. Mm-hmm. She self-medicated, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How long would you say you knew her? You spent time with her. How, over the course of X amount of years, or?
Well, you know, that during that time of having her disco, that was what, early to mid 70s. And then I wasn't really there when the place burned. You know, there had been an accident on the viaduct, which some kind of truck accident that spilled fuel or something, and there was a geyser of flaming liquid coming off the freeway right down onto the club, and it closed and had to be repaired and reopened. But from then on, and then Shelley would, you know, for years, I would talk to her occasionally on the phone, and she was often drunk and would be sort of obnoxious. And I remember being kind of impatient with that. I think she was pretty lonely. I think she was definitely struggling with alcohol. She'd probably burned through all of her money. And Marty was long gone from her life. I don't know who she had been with, if anybody. So I think she was lonely and sick and unhappy. So it probably didn't end well for her.
After the fire, she tried to, she reopened, right? She fixed what damage had happened, and she reopened the bar. And there wasn't quite the success that it had prior to the fire. Do you have any knowledge as to why that might have been the case?
I just suspect that the sort of the disco fever had kind of moved on. One, you know, window of time when she opened up the bar and it opened, the disco scene was going, gay people were coming out of the closet, and it was a lot of energy and a lot of excitement. And I think that whether there'd been the fire or not, it may have, you know, peaked, just like entertainment, things like that do. They don't last that long. And as we watch Seattle, you know, evolve and change so much, I think it's great to recall, you know, some of the pioneers. In her way, she was a pioneer in Pioneer Square. So here's to you, Shelley.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin.
That was sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad talking with Bruce Bowles. Well, this is Gabriel Spitzer here with Warren Langford. Warren's the one whose email led us down this whole rabbit hole that we're exploring right now. So far we've gone from the disco tape to an actual disco. Not a huge leap there, right? But I'm going to pull back the curtain a little bit now on how we find our stories. So in researching Shelley's leg, I came upon this actually really cool resource for Seattle history stories that I hadn't been aware of. It's a podcast called The Seattle Files. Are you familiar with Seattle Files?
I've heard of it.
Okay, so what they do is they take on a different weird chapter of Northwest history each episode, and they actually talk it over with a comedian. And I learned something that totally blew my mind, although, you know, it's not news to some people, and it wouldn't have surprised me if I'd been paying more attention. But in the late 1800s, a lot of immigrants were coming to Seattle to open businesses, and among them was a guy named Frederick Drumpf. Does that name mean anything to you?
No.
Well,
wait. Drumpf.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that Donald Trump's?
Yes.
Whoa.
Frederick Drumpf was Donald Trump's grandfather, and he opened a business in Pioneer Square. And, you know, he served food, and now there was a rumor that as part of his business, he also at least hosted prostitutes, if not actually facilitated prostitution. So naturally, my eyes bug out of my head, and I said, we got to find out if this is true.
Yeah.
We got to figure out if there's anything to the rumor. So we found an independent historian in Seattle named Rob Ketcherside and asked him for the real deal.
It's completely not credible. There's no evidence that he had any association with any sort of criminal activity at all. The number of mistakes in local stories about Fred Trump is really amazing. They took one misguided story and then added error upon error to it, to the point where there's photos of the wrong building, not even the building that he had his business in. The building that he had his business in was one story, but you see accounts of him being the pimp for the prostitutes that worked above his store. There's no above his store. It's a single story building. There's just no evidence. We have records of all of the liquor licenses that were given to businesses in Seattle. His restaurant did not have a liquor license even.
So as you hear, it sounds like some of the more salacious rumors about Frederick Trump's time here in the Northwest, probably not a lot to them, at least according to historian Rob Ketcherside. Keep him in mind, by the way, because we're going to be coming back to him in a little bit. But anyway, after that restaurant in Pioneer Square, Frederick Trump would head out into the valleys of what's now rural Snohomish County, and he opened a rooming house in a place called Monte Cristo. Now, the story of Monte Cristo, Frederick Trump aside, is a fascinating one. So here, I'm going to take you there, Warren.
Okay.
Sorry, so it's the late 1800s. You're in eastern Snohomish County, and a prospector climbs a tall peak, and with his binoculars, he scans the horizon. He sees another peak in the distance, and he spots this streak on the rock face. It's a clear sign of something called lead sulfide. Where there's lead sulfide, there's often gold and silver and copper under the ground. So these precious metals actually launched this town called Monte Cristo. And it's in Monte Cristo where the roots of President Donald Trump's family fortune actually first take hold. But before we get into that, we're going to meet David Cameron. He's a historian, and David Cameron loves Monte Cristo, Washington.
It's just a beautiful spot, and it kind of captures you, sort of despite yourself.
David's the vice president of the Monte Cristo Preservation Association, and just to get a sense of how important this place is to David, I'm just going to briefly introduce his wife, Louise Lindgren.
Oh, when I married David, I married Monte Cristo.
So Louise is a history buff herself, and that's actually how the two of them met.
We were both at the League of Snohomish County Heritage Organizations meeting.
Eventually, the two of them would snowshoe into Monte Cristo together, along with a Methodist minister, and get married there by the ruins of this century-old mining town. So David says that because of where Monte Cristo was, way up in the mountains, mining there was never easy.
So how do you move large amounts of rock? We're talking about tons of rock. This means aerial tramways, so you aren't going to pack it out on your back.
But when you say tramway, then we're talking like a ski lift type of a scenario?
Think of big garbage cans mounted up on wire ropes and with towers in between as a ski lift. Well, you're going to have to build a railroad. Somebody's going to have to build a smelter.
So they needed more money.
They needed major money. And the majority of that money came from John D. Rockefeller. And so Rockefeller money basically came to control Monte Cristo.
So Monte Cristo gets built up very quickly. Yep. What does it look like there? Does it look like just a big industrial kind of, you know, landscape, or is there the trappings of a town growing up around it?
No, it looks very much like a typical Western town. First of all the buildings are made out of wood. And there's no sense making anything out of brick, because your typical Western mining town only lasts for about 20 years, and then the ore is played out.
What would the kind of feel of the town or the culture be like? I mean, are we talking Deadwood? I mean, is there violence and prostitution and all that kind of fun Wild West stuff?
The guys that were working there, you know, they were putting in 10-hour days and doing this dig, slam, shovel, blast, that kind of thing. On the weekends, they could get down and they could blow out at the saloons. So there was an awful lot of drinking. There's an awful lot of gambling, occasional fights. And on the sporting life, it's really hard to know, but virtually every community had had prostitution and a red light district, because that was the custom of the times, and you had a huge number of single men.
Now, you'll have to forgive me. I've not heard that charming euphemism before, the sporting life.
Oh, okay. If you're a sporting lady, for example, for one reason or another, you're making your living primarily from prostitution.
Why don't we take a moment to talk about what a person who turned out to be one of the more famous and well-known residents of Monte Cristo, Frederick Trump. Who was he exactly?
He was a German immigrant who had just become an American citizen when word of the gold rush to Monte Cristo came. And so he packs in a lot of supplies, has enough money to buy lumber and build a boarding house. But he definitely had a good reputation. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been elected as Justice of the Peace. So he must have been respected by the people that were there.
So he was elected Justice of the Peace, and how long did that last?
He was elected in 96, and he left in 97.
What happened next in terms of the town and its fate?
And they began realizing that the ore deposits at Monte Cristo were most valuable on the surface, and they began to peter out when you got farther down. Part of that's because the Cascades are the most recent mountains in North America.
That's sort of the opposite of what you might find in another parts of the country, right? You see something on the surface, you think that there must be much more hidden down below.
Exactly. Any typical Western mining town in the Rockies, for example, but that's not true here. They're good on the surface, but when you get farther down, no. And so something happened that they had no control over, and that was the discovery of gold up in the Klondike. News of this happened in 97. That's when the famous ton of gold arrived in downtown Seattle on the Portland. And keep in mind, this is all in the middle of the worst depression of the 19th century, the second worst in American history. In some cases around here, it was probably worse than the 1930s. So word begins filtering out that there's a huge amount of gold, and all you have to do is go up and take your pan, and you know, you can make millions too.
So did the workforce just start to trickle out?
Yep, including a couple of guys that wanted Trump to go with them. He didn't. He was staying here because he had this going with, you know, with his business. So he helped finance them to go up and grubstake in order to do some claims themselves, which they did. And I'm sure that he began thinking there's more of a future up there than there is down here. And so eventually in 97, he decides to pull out, which was very fortunate because in November, naturally, of 1897, there is the worst flood in recorded history up to this time. Now, when that happens, everything is shut down in Monte Cristo. Everybody has to walk out. So had he stayed, he basically would have lost his investment.
Why is it worth preserving?
Oh, well, it's a really interesting part of mining history right in front of you that you can see, for example, plus railroading history that's involved. The other part is that it's undisturbed. So if you want to get back to the wilderness, if you want to see the green stuff and get away from the concrete, it's still there, even though people have come. They haven't destroyed it.
Can you say more about what that has been like for you? Like, why does it speak to you and keep pulling you back?
I like to understand places. I'm not much of a traveler, but where I go, I like to go deeply into it. I like to know where the creeks go, which trees are over where the critters happen to be, you know, how it looks in various seasons of the year. And I can use my imagination and bring back when I'm not there. But to go back the next year and see what has changed, what's the same. And again, I can walk up the street, and I know people that walked up that same street in the 1890s when they were little kids. Now they're gone now, but you know, they're still living in my memory. And I just delight showing people as to what's there. And you'd be surprised how many people feel the same way, that this is something worthwhile and unique. There aren't many places like that around here.
David Cameron is a historian of Monte Cristo, Washington. We talk in his home in nearby Index, Washington. You're listening to Sound Effect here on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. That is one of the places this rabbit hole led. So just to recap here, we started out with the disco mystery tape that led us to the gay disco Shelley's Leg, which led us to Pioneer Square entrepreneur Frederick Trump, which then led us out to Monte Cristo, Washington, right? Now, when we first asked that historian, Rob Ketcherside, about Trump, he's the guy that basically poo-pooed the rumor that Trump had any involvement with prostitution.
Right.
He kind of rolled his eyes at us when we asked him about that. And he said, well, look, what I really want to talk to you guys about is grocery stores.
Okay. Why?
You know. Oh, you don't? No,
I don't.
Well, listen, this is another one where, I mean, Ketcherside himself went down a rabbit hole for this story. And the tale takes a turn that is so abrupt that we actually had to give a content advisory. So this story contains some pretty graphic descriptions.
Oh, no.
So if you're sensitive to imagery of violence, you might want to tune out. But if you're still with us, you should know that Seattle was home to one of the very first self-serve groceries. and they called it a grossateria. It was a very strange idea at the time, and Seattle was scandalized to the point where people were writing letters to the editor about it.
It said, how far is this going to go? Are we going to have haberdasherias? Which haberdashery was the term for a men's clothing store. So they couldn't imagine men walking into a store, seeing clothes they want, taking them off the shelf, and buying them. They just couldn't imagine that. Someone has to help you figure out what clothes to buy.
So yeah, before this, grocery shopping was always done behind a counter. Like you couldn't, it's like going to Oregon and they don't let you pump your own gas. This was, you know, you'd walk in and you wouldn't get your own groceries. Somebody would get them for you.
So it'd be similar to going to a deli today where you've got a counter. So you walk up to the counter with your list. They go and they pluck stuff off of their stock shelves. You have no say in what brand you're buying. But actually, most people didn't go into the grocery store to do their grocery shopping. A lot of people, even in 1910, in that time frame, would be calling up their grocery store. And the biggest one in Seattle, Augustine and Kier, they had a phone bank of dozens of operators. And then they had dozens and dozens of horse-pulled carts that would deliver the grocery stores around town.
So this is all about to change in Seattle, thanks to our main character here, Alvin Monson. Who is Alvin Monson?
So Alvin Monson is a young man from Nebraska. He showed brilliance early on buying a car in like 1905, which there weren't many cars in 1905. He's 14 years old. He buys a car and he starts charging people to drive them around town because he has the only car, including his own father. He makes a lot of money off of his father. He takes over his dad's grocery business when he's still in his teens and starts trying to figure out how to take this really labor-intensive grocery store and turn it into something that returns more profit than it was doing. One way he did that is to take all of the things that were hidden in the back of the shop and put them on shelves so people actually could know what they were buying and to put the prices on them so they knew how much they were going to pay for the thing that they were going to get.
So he started that in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And where did he take it from there?
He spends every evening trying to figure out what the business model really is. And once he's got it, decides to work his way up the West Coast and decides on Seattle.
So how did he start the operation here? Where did he go and what did it look like?
So it's him and his brother who are starting the chain off to begin with, Walter Monson, who also had run businesses in their hometown. And they have to start downtown first from a visibility perspective. They need to put it in a high-profile spot.
And how do people react to this new thing?
He knew that they were going to be confused. So he reached out and local newspapers ran articles describing this new business and letting people know how they're going to buy food. You have to walk in, pick up your own basket, choose yourself what you need to buy, and then go pay the one employee and leave. Like they had to spell it out for everybody exactly how, what self-service meant.
Did people take to it?
Yeah, immediately successful. So they started in November 1915, and at their two-year anniversary, they had 20 stores already.
So he has this chain of self-service grocery stores. People are getting used to the idea. Sounds like Alvin is kind of at the height of his powers here, right? Would you say that that's the pinnacle?
Yeah, his pinnacle is 1918, because in 1918, he's drafted for World War I.
Was he an eager soldier?
He was not an eager soldier, yeah. He's not a fighter. He's a bean counter.
So literally, yes.
Literally a bean counter, yeah. Finally, in mid-1918, they're sent to the front lines to France on a train of boxcars. For some reason, they weren't able to drive overnight, so they parked all of these soldiers and apparently forgot to switch the tracks back to the main line. So these men are sleeping in the middle of the night, and another train, a supply train, comes through on the tracks and is routed right into them and just completely destroys the six boxcars that are on this track. The descriptions of it from Alvin Monson himself and also in the regimental history are just gruesome.
Let's hear that piece from the official regimental history.
On each side of the track, as far as 60 feet, lay the wreck of boxcars, the dead and dying in grotesque positions. As the engine plowed through the last seven cars, it scrambled trucks, wood, iron, bodies, and rifles in a tangled mess. Feet and arms peeped forth from the wreckage. Blood and brains and dismembered legs and arms were spattered and scattered everywhere. One body rested under the rear wheels of the engines. The only noise was that of the rescue parties, save when the pain of moving brought forth an involuntary groan. With crushed chests, smashed heads, arms and legs broken and cut off, these men lay without a murmur. Men pinned down by the weight of tons on their legs or arms begged the rescue parties to work first upon some other of their comrades nearby. This regimental history is trying to honor the memory of the dead and not paint them as men who were crying for help at the end. And that really feeds into what the problems that were faced in World War I. Alvin suffered shell shock, and the cure for shell shock was rest. No one knew that trauma of the mind needed direct intervention in order to set people back on a path towards health.
So before he even sees combat, he's in the middle of this just horrific, traumatic catastrophe,
right,
in France. Where does he go next? Does he get to the front?
They did go to battle. And the thing that's amazing to me is that Alvin Mommsen was only in the war for 2 months. In September, the first battle starts. In November, armistice is declared. So his life is ruined by 2 months of warfare. And the descriptions of what happens to these men during those 2 months, it seems like it's years of battles. You can't imagine this happening one after another after another.
And could you read a little bit from the descriptions of some of those battles? We have the words of Alvin himself.
So Alvin says, "I went over this hill and some German gunner spotted me and shot through the trees. And I followed the wire down the hill. Then he started shooting good. I went down this hill and I must have gone a mile. I passed a bunch of fellows there. They'd turned black. Dead soldiers. I saw them all over. I saw so many. I don't know how many. And the smell was just something terrible." The first moment he's back in the offices of the grocery chain, he doesn't even say hi to anyone. He just starts recounting really terrible, terrible stories of what happened to him in World War I. His family tried to find ways to help him cope. The first thing they thought was he needs rest. So they sent him to Chicago to live with his relatives and try and recuperate. Unfortunately, in Chicago, they still have the elevated train. They had that in 1919 as well. He describes how the sound of the rails under the train cars reminds him of the train accident, and he passes out. The rest in Chicago doesn't help him at all. In the city, he keeps on encountering things that trigger memories, and it's ridiculously normal things. Things like advertisement that used the word green would trigger the memory of a fellow soldier named Green, and he would relive the moment of that man's death every time he saw that word. Like, how could you avoid the word green, right? Then their next thought was, if rest doesn't help, he was the mind that made Grotcheteria possible. So they thought, if we can get him back engaged with part of his job, surely that will help him. They tried making him the buyer again, one of his fortes. And he starts buying exorbitant amounts of things the store doesn't need at really crazy prices. None of it helps him. He never recovers from the trauma of World War I. So his brother was a great businessman and ran the Grotcheteria chain effectively, but this is a brand new venture. This isn't something you can run by a textbook, and it needs that vision that Alvin Mommsen had and no longer has access to. So the chain remains large for a few years, but then begins dwindling, and in 1926 goes bankrupt.
So how did Alvin then live out his years?
In 1927, he had asked the U.S. government for disability benefits, but the government hadn't acted on that, and so he was forced to sue to prove that his inability to work was caused by the war.
And so that's where we have a lot of his accounts from, the testimony that he gave in that lawsuit. And he won that lawsuit, right?
And he won that lawsuit, yeah. It's 25 years of back pay plus $50 a month for the rest of his life.
So that's one little spark of light.
I don't know that there's any light in it. So 36, he wins. His brother dies in 37, so it's to his mother to take care of him. And 1940 census shows neither of them have employment. They're just living on his disability benefits. And then he dies in 1941. So he only lives for 5 years And it couldn't have been a happy 5 years. There's no sign that he was ever happy or recovered in any means.
So when you stand back and you look at this guy's life, such promise followed by such tragedy, I don't know, what do you take away from it? What do you make of it?
The beginning is really a story of opportunity and how there's things around us that, if just combined together, can make something new and amazing. And then the second half, there's no positive side to it. I wonder how many other men who lived through World War I went through trauma like this. It must have caused damage to our entire country.
So that was independent historian Rob Ketcherside talking about Alvin Monson and the founding of the Grosseteria here in Seattle. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. I'm here with contributor Warren Langford, who sent us down this crazy rabbit hole. And that sort of melancholy story is where we end up.
Yeah. What have I done?
It's my question to you. What have you done? What do you make of the this kind of unpredictable rabbit hole that we went down after you sent us that email?
It's a lot of fun. I love when things kind of work organically and feed into each other.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about sort of jumping from stepping stone to stepping stone that is a whole process of discovery that I don't think that there's a way to shortcut.
No, I don't. I think it's very organic. I think every single show should go just like this from now on, Gabe.
Well, I want to give my heartfelt thanks to Warren Langford, a longtime Sound Effect contributor who now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who's back in Seattle, at least for a visit. Thank mm-hmm. you so much, Warren.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing, with a lot of help this week from Shane Mailing. And we want to welcome our newest producer to the team, Posey Gruner, who will be joining us from here on out. So welcome aboard, Posey. We get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blum, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org, and be sure to tune in next week when our theme is Imperfect Crime. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is 88.5 KNKX.
Hey, you know what else is a term for a rabbit hole?
What?
A Warren.